fighting to protect, implement, and improve the new healthcare law through national and state-based legislative and regulatory campaigns built on grassroots action, public education, communications, policy analysis, and groundbreaking research. HCAN has become a respected voice and national leader on healthcare while continuing to focus on aggressive field activity. Support HCAN, Healthcare for America Now.
This is Margaret Flowers.
And I'm Kevin Zeese. Join us every Monday morning, 11 a.m. for Clearing the Fog.
Speaking truth to expose the forces of greed.
Start the week with your eyes open.
The Fog.
The forces of greed that spin news stories for the benefit of the 1%.
Each week, we feature guests who are working to expose these truths and offer real solutions to the current crises we face.
Knowledge is power, and with knowledge, you will be empowered to act to shift the power to the people.
Monday mornings at 11 a.m. on WeActRadio.com or 1480.
You're listening to Take Action News on We Act Radio, produced at the studios of WPWC 1480 AM in Washington, D.C., your nation's capital.
I got a letter from the government the other day. I opened and read it and burned that. Man, the way that I live, don't concern that. Man, we don't have to settle this another way. A letter from the government the other day. I opened and read it and burned that. Man, the way that I live, don't concern that. Man, we don't have to settle this another way. Movement, music,
move into it. Morning. You're listening to Your World News here on 1480 AM WEAC Radio, WPWC. My name is Naveed Nasser. With me today is my co-host, Solomon Kamishong. Solomon, you there?
Yes, I am. Yes, I am.
Excellent, excellent. Well, we have a show today that I'm personally excited about because of our guests and also because of the topic that we're addressing here. The topic, we're going to use Libya as a jump-off point to talk about the broader topic of imperialism in general, and specifically within the context of Africa. So without further ado, let's go to our special guest. Abayomi, are you there?
Yes, I'm right here.
Excellent, excellent. Could you introduce yourself a little bit to for our audience?
Yes, my name is Abayomi Ezekwe, and I'm editor of the Pan-African Newswire.
Excellent, excellent. So Let's just get right into it. It's been a little bit over a year now since NATO's bombs made the desert bloom in Libya and brought democracy and freedom and gender equality and all sorts of wonderful things to the north of Africa. So let's just take a moment to reflect on that. And Abayomi, could you give your analysis of what's been happening in Libya in the last year or so?
On February the 17th of 2012, that was the beginning of a rebellion against the Libyan Jamahiriya, which was headed by Colonel Muammar Gaddafi, who was martyred on October the 20th of 2011. There was the outbreak of fighting in the eastern part of Libya, largely centered in Benghazi. Mm-hmm. And, of course, this spread to other parts of the eastern and western regions of the country. The government in Libya at that time mobilized its armed forces and militias, and they began to retake territories and to put down this rebellion, which is the right of any sovereign government to protect its national interests and also to put down an internal rebellion. Mm-hmm. What happened was that the imperialist countries, led by the United States and France, went to the United Nations Security Council and pushed for the passage of two resolutions, UN Resolution 1970, which imposed an arms embargo solely against the government of Libya. Then there was UN Resolution 1973, which ostensibly approved the imposition of a so-called no-fly zone over Libya, which was really a pseudo-legal rationale for a widespread naval blockade as well as a bombing operation against Libya. The bombing of Libya began on March the 19th of 2011. During the course of the period between March the 19th and October the 30th of 2011, some 26,000 sorties were carried out, that is, bombing missions, and approximately 10,000 airstrikes were carried out against the North African state of Libya, a country of approximately 6 million people with no real air defense, no real capacity to bring down these sophisticated aircraft as well as missiles that were being launched from the Mediterranean via warships. Also, we had the intervention on the ground of U.S. Special Forces, Central Intelligence Agency operatives. There was also operatives from MI6, the British Intelligence Services, Egyptian Special Forces, Qatari Special Forces, as well as other militia groups from other Middle Eastern and Persian Gulf states.
Mm-hmm.
This was carried out illegally, even according to United States law. There were several congresspeople during the course of the war who attempted to bring President Barack Obama to court for violation of the War Powers Act. There was also efforts to block funding for the war. None of these efforts were successful. The war carried on, and thousands upon thousands of people were killed. Thousands upon thousands more were wounded. There was a displacement of approximately 2 million people who were either driven into exile or displaced. There was a special targeting of black Libyans, many of whom lived along the coast lines in the central and eastern regions of the country. They were driven out of their villages, driven out of their towns. Many of them were locked up in prisons and tortured and murdered. Also, Africans from other parts of the continent who had been in Libya as guest workers were also targeted. And even today, approximately 7,000 Africans remain in prison in Libya, and many black Libyans are living in internally displaced persons camps, even in the capital of Tripoli. So this is how the war was carried out. Now, the African Union, as early as March the 11th, had drawn up a plan for the resolution of the internal conflict in Libya. It had called for a negotiated resolution of the outstanding political issues. It had called for a ban on foreign military interference in Libya, and also for the bringing about of internationally supervised elections. All of these proposals that were put forward by the African Union was rejected. They were rejected by both the imperialist countries as well as the so-called National Transitional Council, which was the umbrella group for the rebel bands that operated on the ground and were protected via air and via sea by the NATO and Pentagon forces.
Mm-hmm.
During the course of the whole war, approximately $160 billion in foreign assets that belonged to the Libyan government were frozen by the imperialist states. There was also a total blockade on bringing in spare parts, food, and other technical assistance to Libya. So the country was essentially strangled externally as well as having internal elements that were fighting on the ground to bring about the overthrow of the Gaddafi government. Since the murder of Gaddafi on October the 20th of 2011 and the blanket bombing of Sirte, which essentially ended that phase of the war, although resistance is still going on inside the country
mm-hmm.
against the MTC rebels. There's been nothing but political and economic chaos inside of Libya. First of all, the Tuaregs, some of whom had fought alongside Gaddafi's government last year during the war, returned to Mali, and some of them engaged in a insurgency that brought about this attempted succession of the northern part of Mali. That, in turn, precipitated a military coup d'etat on March the 21st of this year. And that situation is still very unstable inside neighboring Mali. Also, what has happened inside the country is that we have the continuing incarceration and torture and murder of people who are designated as supporters of the former government. The rebel bands who were never unified and never consolidated under any one unified military command have been fighting each other, have been engaging in all types of criminal activity, including murder, robbery, assault on women. Just a few days ago, there was an attempted, that would appear to be attempted coup d'etat against the puppet prime minister of Libya right now, where some of the militias members targeted his office, fired missiles and weapons into his office, and then some people were killed in that conflict. The problem, they claim, was that their checks that they have been receiving from the Libyan government had been suspended a month ago because of the massive fraud that exists within the new Western-backed Libyan government. There's questions about missing funds to the tune of billions and billions of dollars. There was a Libyan investment authority which claimed that it transferred $2.5 billion to the oil ministry and to the national treasury, and the money was never accounted for. Also, the question of the $160 billion in the so-called sovereign wealth fund, the foreign assets of Libya, there's extreme questions about that in regard to accountability for those monies as well. So what we have in Libya is that the country has gone from the most prosperous, one of the most well-organized states on the African continent, to one that has become a basket case in regard to political continuity as well as economic viability. There's massive unemployment inside the country now. The government has proved to be totally inept. And so, therefore, the resistance continues to this U.S. and NATO-backed intervention of Libya in Libya.
Right.
Thank you for that, Abiyomi. This is Solomon. It's good to hear your voice again on the air. And thank you for joining us once again on Your World News. Brother Abiyomi, I have a question to ask you. As we you know, approach this election season, I guess we're into election season now, and we you know, fast approach the fall in November, where once again the U.S. will put forth its one of its favorite dictators, you know, in this two-party dictatorship known as the Democrats and Republicans. I want to ask you, because when you're talking about Libya, this was large part and parcel orchestrated by a brown face in the White House. Brown face in the White House, you know, exacting war on Africa for very nefarious reasons. Can I ask you what your analysis is of U.S. President Barack Obama's policies towards Africa? Are they different? You know, much different than George Bush's? Are they similar? If so, you know, why? What are the policies that he seems to be lock and step in regarding Africa?
As a close friend of mine has said, you don't become president of the leading imperialist country in the world by challenging the system. Barack Obama is part and parcel of the political system of the United States. We have to start from that point of departure. His policies are similar to the Bush administration, but in my opinion, they're far worse. Because he presented himself during 2008 as a change agent, someone who would rehabilitate the image of U.S. imperialism internationally. That may have happened initially, but I think most people around the world today, and even many people here in this country, see Barack Obama for what he is, and he's a representative of the banks, the transnational corporations, and the Pentagon. And that is pure and simple. If you look at his policies, both domestically as well as his foreign policy, it follows the same pattern of arrogance, the attempt for U.S. hegemony internationally. Some examples include the increasing impoverishment of peoples of African descent, of peoples of Latino descent, and women in general inside the United States. These are figures and statistics that were released by the U.S. Census Bureau, that poverty is increasing among African Americans, among Latinos, and among women in general, particularly women of color. Many people have lost their jobs and continue to lose their jobs. The notion that the unemployment rate is going down is based on faulty interpretation of statistics. There are millions of people who are no longer a part of the labor market because they have been discouraged from looking for work because there's no work to look for. If you look at the gains that have been made by African Americans over the last several decades, most of the income increases and professional status has been achieved through the public sector. Since Obama has been in office, the public sector has lost anywhere between 600,000 and 800,000 jobs. There's a huge process of downsizing and job elimination in the public sector. We can see it in cities throughout the United States. Right here in the city of Detroit, they have placed the city under a so-called financial stability agreement, where there are plans to lay off up to 3,500 civil servants. Thousands of teachers have been eliminated in the city of Detroit. The city is swamped with municipal debt that is actually controlled by the financial institutions. The city of Detroit has to pay $597 million annually in debt service. That's just the interest on the debt, which they claim is some $16.9 billion. The fact of the matter is the city of Detroit will never be able to repay that debt. I don't care how many workers they eliminate. I don't care how many services that are cut. I don't care how many salaries that are reduced and pension funds that are seized and health care programs and educational programs that are eliminated for civil servants. The people will never be able to pay that debt to the banks. So these are the type of developments that are going on, and it's not just Detroit. The city of Flint, Benton Harbor, these are majority African-American cities that have been placed under emergency management. The U.S. congressman, one of them from Fort Detroit, Congressman John Conyers, who's considered the dean of the Congressional Black Caucus, he's the longest-serving African-American in the U.S. Congress, wrote a letter along with other elected officials from Michigan requesting U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder investigate the state of Michigan under Rick Snyder, the Republican conservative governor, whether or not the voting rights of African Americans were being violated due to the imposition of emergency management, which appoints corporate essentially czars or dictators and which nullifies the authority of elected officials as well as trade unions in terms of collective bargaining. They never received a response from Eric Holder in regard to this letter that had been written. Detroit is a majority African-American city. It's has the largest concentration of African-Americans of any other major city in the United States. Some 83% to 85% at least of the city is African-American. The city has voted historically for the Democratic Party, both locally and as well as in national elections. Yet, the Obama administration and the Justice Department, Civil Rights Division, have said nothing about the total evisceration of voting rights and collective bargaining rights for the majority of the African-American people here in the city of Detroit, in the city of Flint, in the city of Benton Harbor, in Highland Park, and other cities throughout the state of Michigan. Now, this economic crisis is just not limited to majority African-American cities. We see similar problems in cities like Providence, Rhode Island, in Jefferson County, Alabama, in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, in Stockton, California. All of these cities are facing economic ruin, bankruptcy, the seizure of public assets, and the wholesale destruction of municipal services and the large-scale downsizing of municipal employees. So this is being done under a Democratic administration. That's on a domestic level, not to mention the rise in racist violence against African Americans, which you've seen a spike just this in the last several months of this year. The killing of Trayvon Martin, the killing of Kendrick McDade in Pasadena, California, the killing of several African Americans in Tulsa, Oklahoma by white racists, the wholesale violation of African-American civil rights and human rights by law enforcement agencies and courts throughout the length and breadth of the United States. The execution of Troy Davis last year in the state of Georgia, where the Justice Department and the White House never made a statement in regard to the Troy Davis case, even though there was substantial evidence that Troy Davis was not guilty. And the White House only made a statement after Troy Davis had been executed by the state of Georgia, saying that they could not intervene because it was a state matter.
Thank you so much for that. We really have to go to a quick break right now. We'll be right back in a couple of minutes. But hold that thought. You're listening to Your World News here on 1480 AM WPWC.
You're listening to WPWC We Act Radio, 1480 AM, weactradio.com.
Take Action News with David Schuster, Saturdays from 12 to 3 on We Act Radio, 1480 AM, and weactradio.com.
Well, for me, it's always been, you know, you report the facts. You report like hell, let the chips fall where they may. And the truth ultimately is what's going to sort of help our society and help all of us. I don't think progressives want a thumb on the scale on the facts. They just want the facts out there. You let the facts out, and progressives will tell you know, we're going to win 70% of the time. You may quibble with the percentages or whatnot, but I think that's just sort of what progressives are looking for, and I think that's where this all sort of meshes with my interest as a journalist. My interest as a journalist is report the facts. Here's what's going on. Here's what the facts say. Here's what history says. Here are the lessons we know we have learned. And let people draw their own conclusions. And I think what's so unfortunate right now in the world of broadcast media is I do think that a lot of conservative radio, certainly conservative television, they're not interested in facts. And that's ultimately where I think conservative media is going to have its downfall, that Americans are hungry. They're just hungry for basic information, hungry for basic facts. You report like hell, you let the chips fall where they may. I think it's natural for all of us who care, who are passionate about politics, who feel like we have a sense about the difference between right and wrong. I think it's okay to let that be part of your coverage. It's important for all of us as broadcasters and journalists. In this day and age, we have to be authentic. You can't be the person who's up in the ivory tower that comes down and tells people, now you must eat your peas. Now, it's all about, we all have personalities, and I think it's being aware sometimes of our own bias, but also being open to the idea that sometimes we're wrong. But we have a dialogue, and we have a passionate dialogue, and we care about this country, we care about this community, and I think that sort of passion is what carries us through.
Hear more from David Schuster, Saturdays from 12 to 3 on Take Action News on We Act Radio, 1480 AM, and weactradio.com.
You're listening to WPWC We Act Radio, 1480 AM, weactradio.com.
And we're back here on Your World News here on 1480 AM WEAC Radio, WPWC. My name is Naveed Nasser. My co-host is Solomon Kamishong. And our special guest for today is Abayomi Ezekiwe of the Pan-African Newswire. Now, Abayomi, to get back to the topic of Africa in general and Libya in particular, how can I phrase this? There was a lot of pushback with regards to taking a strong stand on Libya. There were certain things that were said by people, specifically among the left in the U.S., about how he was killing his own people. And it seemed pretty obvious to me, at least, when I saw the footage from the hospitals in Libya in February and March, that the people that were being injured seemed like they were all men of fighting age. And whereas when you saw the NATO bombings and the devastating results of that, you saw children, you saw families, you saw people whose entire lives had been torn apart, who had been injured in the most horrific way imaginable. When you saw what happened, you know, nobody is perfect, especially no head of state, right? But I don't remember, for example, Gaddafi wiping out an entire city of 40,000 people the way the heroic rebels and revolutionaries did with the city of Tawarga. You know, 40,000 people, right, completely displaced, That city wiped off the map pretty much. It's a ghost town right now. And the people scattered to the winds, ethnic cleansing. And the people who went into Tawurga and did that gave themselves names, for example, like the Brigade to Purge Slaves in Black Skin. So it was pretty, even the Wall Street Journal reported that. So it was pretty clear what their goal was and what their intention was. And I don't care what people think. Gaddafi may have been, the most horrible human being on the face of the earth, and obviously he wasn't. But let's take what the left said at face value with regards to that. He never did anything even remotely comparable to that. And you talked about Sirte, for example. And I saw the footage of Sirte. Sirte looked no different than Fallujah looked in 2004. It looked destroyed. It looked like it was, taken down to the ground, like there was nothing left of that city. Gaddafi never did anything like that, not even remotely comparable to that. So what do you, so let me try to formulate this in a question here. This is a two-part question, I guess. One is, how do you account for the lack of support from the rest of the Arab and Muslim world when this assault happened? Not just the lack of support, but the enthusiastic endorsement of the NATO action, even from people that, like, I really didn't expect it, for example, from the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, but yet that's what they did. I didn't, maybe this isn't quite accurate, but I mean, I was a little bit surprised and shocked to see it coming from, for example, Hezbollah. I was disappointed because I knew that, like, the people on the ground in Algeria, by and large, supported the Libyan Jamahiriya and the Libyan state, but yet the government took a very cowardly stance with regards to that. Former friends, people who no one else had aided in their liberation struggles, aside from Gaddafi, all turned their back. How do you account for that, and how do you account for the impoverishment of the Western left's response to what happened last year? I want to hear your take on this.
Well, in terms of the Muslim countries, Arab countries, there historically has been a lot of divisions among the various political parties, the various governments. Libya had been accused, for example, in the disappearance of a leading Shia clerk back during the late 1970s, which the government denied. But there's also been that lingering suspicion over the decades. Then, of course, you have the situation where the Libyan government had problems with various organizations throughout the Middle East as well as North Africa. But still, the point of the matter is, even if there were contradictions in that regard, the destruction of Libya provided an open avenue for the U.S. Africa Command to penetrate deeper into the African continent. It's also opened up avenues for the same type of destruction of Syria, mm-hmm. Which is allied with Hezbollah, mm-hmm. which is allied with Iran, which mm-hmm. is allied with Hamas, mm-hmm. And which has in the past been a supporter of the PFLP. So, mm-hmm. This is a contradiction. I think it was a grave mistake.
Grave mistake and a very short-sighted.
Look what happened in Syria yesterday, where you had this horrific terrorist attack, two bomb blasts, targeted at the intelligence division there in Syria.
Over 55 killed and 370 injured yesterday, in Damascus. Yeah.
And you have the same type of counter-revolutionary elements mm-hmm. that are being backed by the Persian Gulf states, mm-hmm. Backed by the U.S., backed by the corporate media and the government media here in this country, mm-hmm. that are wreaking havoc right now in Syria. So, people have to mature. They have to recognize that even though there are differences between these different governments, different liberation fronts, different political parties, that when it comes to the question of U.S. imperialist intervention in any part of the world, people should have a categorical position of condemnation and solidarity and defense of the people who are under attack, and even the governments and leaders who are under attack, irrespective of their class character, irrespective of what we may think in regard to the virtues or problems associated with those governments. And this is what has to happen. And this also applies to the left inside the United States. Mm-hmm. The left in the United States is extremely weak, mm-hmm. and the reason why it is weak is because historically it has taken positions that have, in effect, aided imperialism. Mm-hmm. And this is not a problem that just started, and it's not a problem unique to the United States. We can go back to World War One. Mm-hmm. Lenin, during the period leading up to World War One, had taken a position that all of the social democratic parties in Europe should oppose an imperialist war and therefore oppose their own ruling classes in regard to starting another war. All of them reneged on that position, except with the exception of Russia and I think Poland. These are the only two that took a principal position against World War One. So it's a historic problem. And even though people here in this country, some organizations who claim to be on the left, they still have a Eurocentric outlook. They still think that the values mm-hmm. of the United States, the values of the Western world are superior to the values of people in Africa, Asia, and the Middle East. Mm-hmm. And it's a serious problem, but it does explain a lot of the problems that the left has had here in the United States. Now, what was interesting last year was that the African-American community in the United States took a totally different view. And, in fact, it was represented by the tour that Cynthia McKinney did through dozens of cities in the United States in support of Libya. And these rallies drew hundreds of people in each city. There was one here in Detroit. They had them in New York and other cities across the country, where people actually came out to hear Cynthia McKinney and other speakers in defense of Libya. So this really pointed out the fact that the so-called left and so-called peace movement in the United States, or at least the more moderate elements within it, have a long ways to go. And it's the same thing with Syria. Mm-hmm. Many of them are not defending Syria either. Mm-hmm. They want to point out the contradictions within the Arab-Baath Socialist Party government in Syria. Mm-hmm. We're going to have the same problem. We had the same problem associated with Iraq, mm-hmm. same problem associated with Iran. Some of them don't want to defend Iran, which is under tremendous pressure. Their scientists are being assassinated. They're under severe and draconian economic sanctions. All of these things are going on. They're under imminent threat of a military attack either by Israel or the United States.
Yeah.
Yet, people who are right here in the belly of the beast, who are being oppressed by U.S. imperialism, mm-hmm. will not oppose their own ruling class in defense of people in the oppressed countries that are being attacked by U.S. imperialism. So this is a severe contradiction that exists among some of these left organizations, but overall, these groups are heavily marginalized. They really don't have strong ties to the masses.
That's true.
And they have not been successful in their strategic objectives anyway. So I think in the long run, they may prove, if they don't shift their positions, may prove to be completely irrelevant anyway. And new alliances will come about and form. And I think that's the way the struggle will advance here in this country. But these are the contradictions that exist. But they can come for Libya yesterday. They'll come for Syria today. They'll come mm-hmm. for Iran tomorrow.
Mm-hmm.
And then they'll come after some of these same elements.
Mm-hmm.
For example, look at how they responded to the Occupy movement in this country.
Yeah.
Now, initially, they kind of took a hands-off position. Then beginning in New York on October the 14th, they moved to crush the movement. The trade unions came out in their support. They backed off. This went on for perhaps another month, a month and a half. And systematically, every single Occupy encampment inside the United States was attacked and shut down. And it was obvious that this was something that was being ordered by Homeland Security right out of the White House, that they wanted to crush the Occupy movement because it was posing a threat to the status quo in this country by targeting Wall Street, by targeting the banks, and also presenting a problem for the 2012 presidential and congressional elections. When the Democratic Party could not co-opt the Occupy movement, then they set out to destroy it. And that same policy is still intact. There have been efforts to try to retake Zuccotti Park. They've been met by severe repression. Even here in the city of Detroit on May Day, some of the young people wanted to establish a camp just for one night in Grand Circus Park, where Occupy Detroit had been set up for about 6 or 7 weeks between October and November of last year. And the Detroit police liaison with Homeland Security, you know, pulled out all the stops to make sure that not one tent was able to be erected. They brought out sound weapons. They threatened to arrest anybody who tried to erect a tent in that park. So it's obvious that this is a national coordinated policy to try to suppress the Occupy movement or any other mass protest that does not fundamentally support the ruling class and the Democratic Party here in the United States.
I'm glad you brought up the Occupy movement, and I'm also glad you brought up Cynthia McKinney's tour last year, because I went to two of those tour dates, one in Baltimore and one in D.C., and what was interesting is that, by and large, with certain respectable exceptions, and I'm going to name them here, Workers World in Baltimore and Answer / PSL in D.C., by and large, the left basically played an adversarial role when it came to that, and was flinging rotten tomatoes at the whole thing, and really apologizing and making propaganda for the war effort at that point. But, Salman, you have a question for Abiyomi?
Yeah, I want to move a little bit over to the east of Africa. And, Brother Abiyomi, I want to talk about a country that is seldom, you know, mentioned in the Western press, you know, unless it's to once again try to put out a propaganda campaign to reinforce the U.S.'s, you know, destabilization of this country, and that's Eritrea. Could you talk about the U.S. motives behind applying sanctions to Eritrea and the truth on the ground? Because, you know, right now what's being put out in Western media is, you know, labeling Afwerki as a dictator. But when you look at when he comes to UN in New York, you know, you have crowds of upwards of 4,000 to 5,000 Eritreans, you know, cheering him on outside the, you know, outside the UN. In D.C. on the 25th of May, there's going to be a large, you know, protests outside the White House, and mostly comprised of Eritreans. Can you tell us about what most Americans don't know but should know in terms of the truth around Eritrea, and what the U.S. motives are, what the Western states' motives are in terms of applying these sanctions and destabilizing this country?
Well, I think that the U.S. Wants to attack and obliterate any government, any liberation movement, any organization that does not totally kowtow to their political line, that they cannot dominate, that they cannot manipulate. And Eritrea has maintained an independent position in regard to the situation in the Horn of Africa. They have not gone along with efforts that's being engineered by U.S. imperialism in Somalia, where there are several governments. There are military forces from various parts of East Africa that have been occupying Somalia now for at least 5 years, if not more. You have the AMISOM forces there, which are really the troops of Uganda and Burundi, and now most recently Sierra Leone, and, as well as Djibouti, where a U.S. military base, Camp Le Moner, exists. Both a U.S. and French military base in neighboring Djibouti. Then, of course, we have the intervention of Kenya, the Kenyan Defense Forces, who entered last October to also try to crush the Al-Shabaab Islamic organization in Somalia. Eritrea has not gone along with this, and they have accused, i.e., the United States, as well as other hostile governments in the region, have accused Eritrea of supporting Al-Shabaab and supplying it with arms. The Eritreans have denied this. but it flows directly from the same hegemonic policies that are being carried out by the current administration as a continuation of the Bush administration and successive U.S. administrations of dominating the political scene in Africa and in other parts of the world. Any organization, any government that does not go along with the U.S. imperialist line is going to be targeted for regime change and for destruction. And we see it all over Africa, whether it be the Republic of Sudan, whether it's the Republic of Zimbabwe. All of these governments have to bow down to U.S. imperialism. Otherwise, they're going to be targeted for destabilization. So I think the government of Eritrea has fallen into that category. They're trying to isolate Eritrea, and they're trying to bring about a situation where they're demonized as being a supporter of terrorism. They've labeled the Al-Shabaab as terrorists. And what the real agenda in Somalia is relates to the fact that Somalia is oil rich as a nation. They've been wanting for decades to go in and drill oil there. They started in one of the breakaway regions of Puntland in the north of Somalia to drill oil. A Canadian firm, a British interest there as well. The United States, approximately 20 years ago, claimed that they had bought out all the oil concessions in Somalia. So these are the real interests that relate to the situation, as you mentioned about Eritrea. It falls directly into the situation in Somalia, and also the role of the Ethiopian government under Meles Zenawi, who was heavily supported by the U.S. Militarily and politically, and who is also occupying parts of the central region of Ethiopia.
Mm-hmm. All right, so we need to go to a quick break now, but we'll be right back in a couple of minutes. You're listening to Your World News on WEAC Radio, 1480 AM, WPWC, and we'll be right back after these quick messages.
You're listening to WPWC We Act Radio, 1480 AM, weactradio.com.
Friends, David Schuster here, and all of us at We Act Radio are so proud of our neighbors here in Southeast D.C., especially one of our partners, The Ark. The Ark is at 1901 Mississippi Avenue Southeast. It's the home to some of Washington's best, including the Washington Ballet, the Levine School of Music, Boys and Girls Club, and the Children's Health Project all provide a number of programs and services within the very same facility. The Ark is also home to the Ark Theater, the only theater east of the river, which hosts a variety of dance, music, and theatrical shows each year. Almost everything you could want is at the Ark, so stop by and see them. The Ark, 1901 Mississippi Avenue in Southeast. For more information, visit the Ark's website, www.thearkdc.org, or call 202-889-5901. The Ark, part of Southeast D.C.
Hi, I'm Curtis, and I'm so glad that I've got my own, you know, so glad that I can see. I've got a natural hide. The man can't put no thing on me, and he can't put no thing on you either. Keep your nose clean. Don't be no junkie. Remember, Freddy's dead.
You're listening to WPWC We Act Radio, 1480 AM, weactradio.com.
Back here on Your World News on WEAC Radio, 1480 AM. My name is Naveed Nasser. My co-host is Solomon Kamishong, and our special guest today is Abayomi Ezekiwe of the Pan-African Newswire. Abiyomi, you touched on this subject before we went to the break, but I would like you to talk about it a little bit more, which is the issue of Sudan and South Sudan and what's happening right now in the disputed region between the two countries, where a great deal of the natural wealth of the country is located, the oil wealth specifically. Could you expound on that a little bit?
Yes. Historically, there's been a conflict between the southern and northern regions of Sudan, going all the way back to the period of British colonialism. The British ruled the country not as one single political entity, but as separate entities. Therefore, when the country gained its national independence in 1956, just prior to that, a civil war erupted because the people of the South felt as if they were being marginalized from the whole new political dispensation under independence. So between 1955 and 1972, there was a civil war in Sudan, which in fact hampered its ability to develop as a national state. Then in 1972, there was a peace treaty that stopped the war for 11 years. And then in 1983, it resumed again and lasted for some two decades, up until 2003. It resulted in the deaths of hundreds of thousands of people. And as I mentioned before, it hampered the national development strategies of Sudan. Sudan is prior to the partition, which took place last year, was the largest geographic nation state on the African continent. Now, last January of 2011, there was a national referendum in the southern part of Sudan, in which the overwhelming majority of the people voted in favor of secession. This was an interesting development because the now deceased former leader of the Sudan People's Liberation Movement, John Garang, died mysteriously in a helicopter crash in Uganda a couple of years prior to that, prior to the elections. And he, according to many, did not favor succession but favored autonomy within a broader Sudanese state. Now, the division of Sudan is extremely problematic because South Sudan, as a result of the historic evolution of colonialism under the British, as well as the ongoing civil wars that had been going on since 1955 intermittently, was extremely underdeveloped, and it still is. There's tremendous oil resources in the South, but the pipelines lead out of the South into the North. So with the worsening of relations between the Republic of Sudan and the Republic of South Sudan, the production of oil in South Sudan has been suspended. So therefore, with 98% of their foreign exchange earnings being based upon oil, that is in the South, and a large number in the North as well, this has essentially crippled the national economy in South Sudan and created a tremendous amount of chaos within this newly independent African state. The Republic of Sudan under President Omar Hassan al-Bashir indicated that they would accept the outcome of the national referendum of January of 2011 and recognize the Republic of South Sudan, which declared itself independent in July of 2011. But there were major issues that were not resolved leading up to the secession and partition of the country, one being the border demarcations and another being the utilization of the vast oil resources inside the country. Mm-hmm. We have to understand that Sudan is an emerging oil-producing state. Leading up to the partition of the country, they were producing approximately 500,000 barrels of oil per day. The interesting factor involved in this is that the People's Republic of China controlled 80% of the oil concessions inside of Sudan. And this, of course, posed a extreme problem for U.S. imperialism and other Western imperialist nations who were essentially excluded from being involved in the development of the oil industry in Sudan. This did not sit well with the U.S., with Britain, and with the State of Israel, and they, of course, have been supporting not only the succession of the SPLA, but also supporting this increased hostility between South Sudan and North Sudan. We also have to look at the situation in the western part of the country in Darfur, which is another flashpoint, which is another potential succession from the central government in Sudan. So we have a situation where the imperialists want to really break up Sudan into three partition states in order to weaken it, and also in order to seize and control and dominate the oil industry in that region. So in just recently, the South Sudanese army invaded the Hegeleg oil fields and took control of them for several days. This act was met by international condemnation. They were forced to withdraw from the Hegeleg oil fields. They have now been retaken by the Republic of Sudan military forces. But several foreign nationals were arrested 2 weeks ago in the region. And at the same time, it has essentially shut down oil production in the south of Sudan. So the president of the Republic of South Sudan, Mr. Salva Kiir, has traveled 2 weeks ago to the People's Republic of China for high-level discussions in seeking financial assistance from China. They made a request for Chinese assistance in constructing a new pipeline that would channel oil through Kenya and bypass the Republic of Sudan. This was rejected, as far as I know, by the Chinese government. But the Chinese government did say that they would loan South Sudan some $8 billion. There's also a problem in South Sudan of ongoing sectional conflict as well. There's a South Sudanese Liberation Army, the SSLA, which is in opposition to the SPLM headed by Salva Kiir. They have been engaging in armed struggle against the government, claiming that the government of Salva Kiir is corrupt, that they're not accountable for the oil revenue or for other assistances coming in to South Sudan. Then, of course, there's a problem around Jonglei between various groups there who have been fighting that has brought about a tremendous amount of dislocation as well. So in addition to the ongoing conflict between the Republic of Sudan and the Republic of South Sudan, there's also the internal problem within South Sudan itself. So the country essentially is being crippled in its infancy. They're claiming that some $2 billion of oil revenue is unaccounted for in the Republic of South Sudan, and there's really no strategy on the part of the Republic of South Sudan on how to deal with this crisis with the North. Since oil production is shut down, they really don't have a plan to bring about the national development of the country. And they're going to have to get a hold on the massive corruption, reported corruption that is going on there. Otherwise, they're not going to be able to build themselves up to be a viable state. We also have to look at the role of the state of Israel. Israel has been, as I mentioned before, been a strong supporter of the SPLA. Mm-hmm. They've also been a supporter of some of the groups in the Darfur region as well,
mm-hmm.
Which have been fighting against the Republic of Sudan government. Israel bombed Sudan twice over the last several years. One incident occurred in 2010 where they claimed that there was arms smuggling going on from Iran through Sudan to Egypt and to the Gaza region that is controlled by Hamas. Also, there was another bombing that took place last year as well. So there's a lot of hostility between the State of Israel and the Republic of Sudan, as well as the United States imperialists favoring the Republic of South Sudan, and in fact encouraging the succession, at the same time bringing about increased hostilities between the Republic of South Sudan and the Republic of Sudan. So it's a tragedy. Because we have, on the one hand, the previously largest geographic nation state in Africa with tremendous oil resources, also tremendous natural gas resources, water resources, the recent construction of a dam there in the northern part of Sudan that could potentially provide a lot of hydroelectric power, not only to Sudan, but throughout the entire region, being stifled as a result of imperialist intervention and destabilization efforts in that part of Africa.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm glad for your analysis. I really appreciate it. And the one thing I would like to add is that there's another, what's the word I'm looking for here, contradiction at play in Sudan, which we've seen again in Libya and Syria, which is the U.S. supposedly is engaged in a war against terror, and Al-Qaeda is bad in Afghanistan, in Pakistan, and Yemen, but Al-Qaeda is great in Libya and Syria and even in Darfur in western Sudan. We're talking about Hassan Turabi, who's the head of an Islamist faction closely allied with these Salafi and Wahhabi movements, who is essentially a beneficiary of U.S. foreign policy in Darfur, and even, frankly, of Israeli foreign policy in Darfur and in Sudan. And we've seen the same thing happening over and over again across Africa, across the Middle East, across now even extending into South Asia, where on the one hand, these Islamist movements are used as a boogeyman in order to justify what U.S. imperialism does, and on the other hand, they also the financial and military beneficiaries of U.S. imperialism. So, in any case, we need to sort of wrap things up here, but I would just like to remind listeners that you're listening to Your World News on WEAC Radio, 1480 AM. My name is Naveed Nasser. My co-host is Solomon Kamishong, and our special guest today has been Abayomi Ezekiwe of the Pan-African Newswire. Abayomi, I'd like to thank you for coming on the air, and we should do it again in the not very distant future. Your analysis is really welcome, really needed, and as far as both of us are concerned, very much appreciated. Solomon, do you have something to say in the last minute or so?
No, I just want to just echo what you said. It's very much appreciated your time and analysis on this this program, because as Naveed said, you know, yeah, it was a technical difficulty.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you know, his analysis is very much needed, not just for this program, but, you know, for the masses. And unfortunately, the corporate media methodically and will continue to deliberately drown out, you know, these perspectives and replace them with stuff that has very little substance, but basically is just a rash of psychological operations. So, Naveed, we just got to keep on keeping on and keep on putting our voices out there, our perspectives, as well as the brilliant guests that we bring on this program.
Absolutely. And we're going to do it again next week. You've been listening to Your World News here on 1480 AM, WEAC Radio, WPWC. My name is Naveed Nasser. My co-host, as always, Solomon Kamishong. And our special guest today was Abayomi Ezekiwe of the Pan-African Newswire. Please visit the Pan-African Newswire online. Just Google Pan-African Newswire. It'll come right up. It's a blog spot. But you'll love it. It's really great, in-depth, and very much needed analysis of what's going on when it comes to the anything having to do with the African diaspora, with the continent of Africa, and with imperialism and resistance to it. So, again, Your World News, WEAC Radio, 1480 AM. We'll be back same time and same place next week.
On the floor of the Congress or the Senate, that's the government. Any kind of dilly-dallying, that's the government. Any kind of pussy-footing, that's the government. Any kind of act that's designed to delay, or deprive you and me right now of getting full rights, that's the government that's responsible. And any time you find the government involved in a conspiracy,
this is the point of no return. I can never go back. Life without.
Hi, this is Chris Hedges, and when I'm in Washington, I don't want my news filtered through corporate sponsors. I want to hear the truth, which is why I listen to D.C.'s only independent radio station, WEAC Radio, 1480 AM, WPWC, Washington's progressive working community. WEAC Radio, do something.
You're listening to 1480 AM We Act Radio, and now it's time for the news.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. AFL-CIO political director Mike Podhorzer says the labor movement is using a super PAC called Workers' Voice to directly empower labor and progressive activists. The law calls it a super PAC, but Podhorzer says it's very different from the corporate super PACs launched by people like Karl Rove. And it's an antidote to the misleading TV ads that corporate cash will flood our airwaves with during the presidential campaign.
The labor movement believes that the only antidote is going to be the truth that people speak to each other one-on-one. And so we've set up Workers' Voice not to compete with Rove dollar for dollar, but to recruit and connect and empower progressive activists all over the country to fight for candidates who are going to be for progressive issues and fight against the lies that are going to be on TV.
Workers' Voice lets people who contribute to the fund decide how it's used. The AFL-CIO is implementing a more independent political effort on behalf of working people, and Podhorzer says Workers' Voice reflects that.
Many people were asking, well, what does that exactly look like? And this is part of what it looks like. It looks like returning power to the people who do the work and care about it and are affected by the economy, and going bottom up, not top down, and creating the network and the tools that people need to be effective organizers.
Does the U.S. need a national paid maternity leave policy for workers as most other nations have? Jesse Russell takes a look.
The United States of America is one of the few countries on the planet that doesn't have a paid maternity.